The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good morning. Those of you who have been listening to the last few weeks of talks know that I gave a couple of talks on how the Buddha taught. And then last week I gave a talk about how to be a student from the point of view of the Buddha, what the Buddha said about being a student. And what students and teachers have in common is the teaching that goes between them. So I thought today I would talk about the teaching that in Buddhism, the teachings of the Buddha, the teachings that are studied by Buddhist students. And it's often referred to as the Dharma. In Pali, the language of our tradition, it's Dhamma, without the R, double M. So the Dharma is sometimes seen as being a mysterious entity. Sometimes language like profound is used. Unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect. In the Zen tradition, they chant unsurpassed. Before every Dharma talk, they chant, unsurpassed, penetrating, perfect Dharma is rarely met with even in 100,000 million kalpas, having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to fully, where does it go? Fully, I now vow to fully embrace. So, you know, solemnly chanted, and it's kind of suggests that this is like, you know, this is like mysteriously or profoundly religious. And in fact, when I studied Buddhism and Zen, and when I studied Mahayana and great philosophers like Nagarjuna, I got the impression that the Dharma was this amazingly profound, complex set of paradoxes or incomprehensible aspects. So the talks these last weeks, not about Mahayana or Zen, but about the earliest tradition of Buddhism, coming back from the time of the historical Buddha. And what does he mean by the Dharma? So there's a passage that's often chanted in this tradition about the Dharma, and it goes something like, I'm not going to chant it, the Dharma is visible here and now. It is immediately effective, inviting inspection, onward leading, and to be experienced by the wise. So the Dharma is immediately effective and visible here and now. So back in the time of the Buddha, this claim was made, and people come to the Buddha and say, what do you mean the Dharma is visible here and now? And now if you have some mysterious, mystical idea of the Dharma, some radically altered state of consciousness or some radical new perception, kind of non-dualistic perception of things or some mysterious penetration of the true emptiness of all phenomena, then, you know, it takes some doing to get to the seeing how it's visible here and now. But if you go back to these teachings of the Buddha, it's very seldom that he said things that were kind of mysterious or sounded mystical. In fact, if someone asked him questions like this, one of the common beginning points for him to explore the question was to refer them to something they already knew. And I think that this is a very useful way of, whenever you hear Buddhist teachings, is to don't consider how it's unusual or profound or foreign, but rather assume you already know it. And in what way do you know it? Where in your life do you know it? How do you know it? And how is it useful in how you already know it? And then from your own experience, then how can you expand its usefulness into more areas of your life? So I suspect, to try to choose an example that you're all familiar with, I hope, maybe. Maybe I hope not, but... But I suspect most of you had the experience of having a pebble in your shoe. And when you have a pebble in your shoe, you know, and it's the pebble's digging into your soles of your feet as you walk, you could just keep going along, content to get the massage and the blister and whatever it does. But most people feel the pain of the pebble, and they would, at first opportunity, would probably stop and take off the shoe and pull the pebble out and then keep walking. And in walking, feeling the relief, or feeling that's good, now it's not irritating the foot anymore. So in that situation, something was, you use the word visible here and now, experienced here and now, you experienced the pebble and the pain. And it invited something, it invited that you look closely and take off the shoe. It was onward leading, in the fact that once you're kind of aware of it and aware that you can do something, most people will take that pebble out, especially if it's sharp. And to be experienced by the wise themselves, immediately effective, experienced by the wise, it's pretty immediately effective to take the pebble out. And it's experienced by the wise, and here the assumption is you're wise enough to take the shoe off and the pebble out. And that's the experience, something you're supposed to do for yourself. It isn't like you have a pebble in your foot and you go around telling everyone else, take off your shoes and look for pebbles. You know, it's something, that doesn't make any sense, right? Someone has a pebble on their shoe and I'm lazy, so you guys got to go look at your shoes. No, the only place that's going to be helpful for you is to take off your own shoe and do something about it, right? So there's an example, maybe. So another example, perhaps, that and maybe this one you don't have to, if it doesn't work for you, you can retranslate it into your own life somehow. But maybe you're on the computer, and there's something really intense that you're doing on the computer, and at some point you start feeling like you're getting a strain, a headache from it. And you feel that tension, you feel the way you're straining and looking, leaning over. And you start to, at some point you start feeling the dis-ease, the uneasiness of the tension and how the headache is coming on. And enough so that it gets your attention away from your absorption in what's on the screen. And then you notice, wait a minute, I'm really engaged here in a tense way. And if I continue this way, the headache's going to get worse. I think I need to do something to change. I have to keep doing the computer work for whatever reason, but perhaps I can relax my shoulders, I can sit back, I can not be straining so hard with my eyes. I could just kind of relax in my body a little bit, or relax in my mind a little bit. And so a person does that, and perhaps you've done something like this, and then you feel the benefit of that. You feel more relaxed. It could be the same thing with driving. You can be tense driving, and then you can relax. And you can feel the problems of being tense, and then you can relax. This morning, when I was making breakfast for my kids, I got involved a little bit. I could feel, it wasn't very dramatic, but I could feel a little difference. It was very subtle, in my forearms, that as I was making the waffles and getting the batter and doing all this stuff, I could feel there was a little bit of tension in my forearms as I was doing it. And as I was reaching for things, it was this tension, kind of like I was in a hurry to get it. And when I noticed that, I thought, you know, this wasn't particularly painful. It wasn't painful at all, but I kind of felt, you know, this... It was more like, it wasn't so much like a problem, it was just like, I think there's another way. And so I relaxed this little tension in my arm. And one of the things I noticed was my arms became much more fluid as they reached for the eggs or the flour or whatever. And it felt nice. It kind of just kind of, as if there was, you know, getting the little sugar in my hand wasn't the point. Getting done with the making the waffles is not the point. It was just kind of there doing each thing for itself. It felt very nice. So here I'm offering you a variety of very practical examples from your own life, that some, or could be from your own life, that is a reference point for how we're going, how the Buddha then would talk about how the Dharma is visible here and now. So when he talked about how the Dharma is visible here and now, the first example he would use, once he had people's attention, maybe this way, he would say, sometimes he'd do as a question format, he would say something like, when you're caught in greed, lust, caught in desire in a strong way, is that painful or not painful? Is that stressful or not stressful? And the person would say, yeah, it's, to be caught in it, to be in the vice of greed is pretty painful. And then if you let go of it, let go of the vice, let go of the clinging, is that painful or not painful? And that's not painful. There's relief, there's freedom then from that particular clinging. And with that as the example, the Buddha would say, this is how the Dharma is visible here and now. This is how you know it for yourself. So you know for yourself the cost of greed. That cost, the tension, we could say, the suffering, invites inspection. So when you come and look at it more carefully, just like you would look at the pebble in your shoe. Look at it, experience it more fully. What is this? And then the part of the Dharma is not just seeing it, but then letting go. And just as taking the pebble out is immediately effective, just as letting go of the tension in my arms is immediately effective in some way, just like changing your posture and letting go of a little bit of tension in your posture is immediately effective. So if you can loosen up, lighten up, free yourself from the greed, that's immediately effective. You can feel the immediacy of that. And then it's onward leading. It's a very interesting term. It's onward leading. It leads somewhere. I like to think of it as water flows downhill. Or a ball rolls downhill if you let go of the ball. There's something that happens inside of us that if we hold ourselves tight and clinging, if we grasp, if we get tense, it limits or holds back a certain unfolding, a certain onward movement in ourselves. And the onward movement, as I understand it, that is held in check, is the deeper and deeper letting go, relaxation that can happen. Because there are layers and layers of ways in which people cling. Many of them we don't even know we have because we're not so attentive to ourselves. We're not so deeply aware. So you might be aware of attention, you might be aware of headache, but there is, you know, kind of something more physical. But then as you get still and quiet enough, or as you begin relaxing and letting go, you start becoming aware there's actually more subtle and more subtle things going on. And so the movement of letting go is onward leading because it helps us to see deeper what further can let go and what further can let go. And that movement of looking, experiencing it, letting go, experiencing the benefit of that, is something here it says, the Buddha said, is to be experienced by the wise. So then the Buddha went on and said the same thing for hate. Can you, you know, when you experience hate, there's a suffering, when you let go of the hate, is it freedom from suffering? And then he did the same thing for delusion in talking to people. Now what's interesting about this definition, when you see the, this is how you see the Dharma. So some people might protest and say, well, Dharma is more profound than that. I mean, this is supposed to be one of the great world religions. It must be some profound philosophy, you know, of the Dharma here, that this is, that's not being touched here. You know, Buddhism, isn't it about the not self? You know, I mean, that's mysterious and paradox, and that's something which I'll you know, going to read great philosophy books to try to understand what is a self and what's a... That's where the Dharma is. I better go to the library. But for the Buddha, he said, if you want to see the Dharma, you can see it in this movement, in something that's experiential here and now, that you can look and inquire and inspect for yourself without a book. And what you can understand for yourself is if you're in the caught in greed, hate, and delusion or not. And greed, hate, and delusion are considered to be the kind of the convenient terms, for categories for the foundational clingings in the mind that lead to all the others that we have. So somehow every all kinds of cling we have somehow have the roots, they say, in greed or in hate or in delusion. So here, in saying that this is the Dharma, the Buddha is not offering something metaphysical. He's not offering something supernatural. He's not offering some great tenet that they have to believe in. That, I mean, you have to believe in it a little bit. You have to believe that you suffer and that you can become free of the suffering. But it's not like some, you know, it's not like a religious tenet in the way we often hear in the West think of a religious tenet. So in this way, one discovers the Dharma. So it's become something very personal and only to be discovered in oneself. And I'm sorry to say this for those of you who have written Dharma books. Dharma books don't contain any Dharma. All they do is they point to where the Dharma is. And the only place they can point to find it is in you. Because from your point of view, the Dharma exists nowhere else but in you. But only if you do this turning inwards to understand and to feel the pebble. And if, you know, you don't have to do that, but if you have, you know, if a pebble in your soul, in your shoe, it's an ordinary thing to take the shoe off. If you feel a pebble in your mind, it's a relatively ordinary thing to stop and take that pebble out. You're encouraged to do that. So again, then there might be these protests. Is this enough to be the Dharma? Dharma certainly must be more. So I want to read to you a few passages from this ancient tradition, from the teachings of the Buddha, where he defines the Dharma in different ways. Don't take it as being the final definition, but see if you listen to these different definitions or descriptions, see if you can follow here some of the common kind of the overarching theme in this or the scope of it. So this is what the Buddha taught to his foster mother when she asked him for the teachings. As for those qualities of which you may know yourself, these qualities lead to dispassion, not to passion, to being unfettered, not to being fettered, to shedding, not to accumulating, to modesty, not to self-aggrandizement, to contentment, not to discontent, to seclusion, not to entanglement, to arouse persistence, not to laziness, to being unburdensome, not to being burdensome. You may definitely hold, this is the Dhamma, this is the teachings of the Buddha. So, again, here you see that the Dharma, the teachings of the Buddha, are not defined metaphysically, supernaturally, philosophically, but rather they're defined or described to personal qualities that you can know for yourself. You can know whether you're content or discontented. You can know whether you're living under self-aggrandizement or whether you're the opposite or modest, says here. You can know whether you're caught up, entangled, or whether you're independent from things. You can know whether you're caught in passion, caught by it, kind of, or whether you're dispassionate in a good way. Um, here's another definition of the Dharma. The Buddha expounded to him the Dharma special to the Buddhas. So here is special to the Buddhas. Oh, good, this is special. So what is a teaching that's special to the Buddha? Now we're going to get to the philosophy. Suffering, its origin, its cessation, and the path. So in this kind of vein, here's another definition of the Dharma. Doing no evil, engaging in what's skillful, and purifying one's mind, this is the teaching of the Buddhas. So again, it's something very personal, and in a sense, individual or private. This is something you have to do for yourself. In this regard, the Buddha talked about the Dharma as being like a raft. You know, the analogy was, if you're walking through the woods and you come to a river that you have to cross, and so you might, maybe you can't swim, and so you build a raft out of branches and trees you find, and then you take the raft across, and then the Buddha said, if the person gets across the river, and is going to continue walking in the woods for a long distance, would it be wise to then pick up the raft and put it on your shoulders and start walking through the woods with the raft? And the answer is supposed to be, no, it's not wise. It's kind of a burden to have to carry the raft. So the Buddha said, in the same way, I teach the Dharma to be like a raft, that you use it to ferry you across, but then you don't carry it with you anymore. So you use it to do this inspection, you do this to this mindfulness, to explore, to do this work, this personal work, and then you can leave it behind. Now again, for those of you who find this is very unsatisfying to have this almost ethical kind of teachings at the heart of Buddhism that has to do with how we behave, how we are, qualities of mind and heart, how we clean ourselves up internally. You want something more profound, something more challenging. So here's one for you. The Buddha teaches the Dharma for the elimination of all standpoints, decisions, obsessions, adherences and underlying tendencies, for the stilling of all formations, for the relinquishing of all attachments, for the destruction of craving, for dispassion, for cessation, for nibbana. Now that sounds a little bit more, you know, lofty and wonderful and like this, you know, this sounds good, you know, right? Those of you who want the lofty religion, you know, religion is supposed to be kind of, you know, freed from greed, hate, and delusion. I mean, that's like, you know, my mother told me that. I don't need Buddhism for that. But what Buddhism is in the definition of the Dharma as being onward leading, suggests something I think profound, and that is that to do this thoroughly, to do this inner work thoroughly of letting go of clinging, greed, hate, delusion, fear, to do it thoroughly brings on something, you know, involves a radical or dramatic transformation in the person. So I want to try to convey this to you a little bit here by taking the topic of mindfulness itself. So there's nothing in these definitions of that puts mindfulness as the purpose of Buddhism. The purpose is to become mindful. Purpose is to be in the present moment. Sometimes in the Western Dharma, mindfulness in the present moment is almost treated like the Buddhist god, like the end-all and be-all, everything that's good. But here, what's emphasized is not the present moment, not mindfulness in and of itself, but rather the way in which mindfulness helps do this inner work of freedom, of freeing us from the way the mind is caught and clinging. So then, and we're a mindfulness tradition here. We practice mindfulness, which is paying, you know, what is mindfulness? And, you know, I've been teaching mindfulness and practicing it now for 30 years, and I don't actually know what it is. So that's, you know, I teach intro classes in mindfulness, and, but now if you find, now I can, you know, to you guys I can admit it. I'm not sure what it is. But I can get close enough to it. And that's, close enough is good enough. You don't have to have exact definition. It's a functional definition. So mindfulness is the capacity to pay attention, to bring awareness to something, to recognize what's happening, to know what's happening in the present moment. The satipatthana, sati means mindfulness, upatthana or patthana means to stand. Sometimes it's said to stand close to attend to bring our attention or awareness and attend to something is mindfulness. So when we bring, so a big part of this is to be mindful, because without mindfulness, without attention, without attending to our foot, we don't notice the pebble. If we don't attend to our posture, or we don't feel the tension we're holding. If we don't attend to our mind and heart, we won't see how we're consumed or burning up with hate or frozen in fear. And it's easy to be so focused on our concerns or on things that we don't notice. That's why, you know, being on the computer absorbed in something is not until the tension gets big enough that we notice something, that it screams, so we notice that you're caught. But if you're mindful more often, if you're not caught in what you're thinking about, then you'll notice more often how you are, and earlier on you can relax and not and free yourself from being caught. So mindfulness says is very important to cultivate and develop so we can notice the pebbles sooner and free ourselves sooner. There's other reasons, other benefits of mindfulness, but for this purpose I'll mention those. As a practice develops of mindfulness, one of the important areas of mindfulness is to be mindful of mindfulness itself. Now, to be mindful of mindfulness itself, is to know that you know. So it sounds a little bit abstract, perhaps, knowing that you know, but there are situations in life where not only you clearly know something, you know that you know. So an example might be if you wake up from a really great nap, middle of the day nap, you really wake up refreshed, it's beautiful light coming in through your windows, and you know, you're content and happy and satisfied, nothing you have to do, and you wake up and you just look around, you see this beautiful light streaming into your room, and everything seems kind of still or beautiful or something. And you're just there enjoying it. And you know that you're enjoying it. You know that you know. There's something about knowing that's there. Or the example I gave the other day was if you have sometimes in a dramatic near accident in a car. You know, you're driving along, discussing whatever, thinking in your mind, you know, whatever fantasies or ideas you normally would do. You know, maybe not so profound. Some of you aren't always profound in your thinking as you go through your day. and so you're going along, and then there's this near accident on the freeway, and those superficial thoughts that you're having just vanish completely. And you're completely present. It's like you know, the reset button on your computer. Maybe because adrenaline is rushing through you. And so you suddenly you're awake and aware and grateful to be alive. And the sense of immediacy of attention and awareness is so strong that it isn't so much what you know with awareness that stands out, but the fact that you are aware, just the fact that you're aware, wow. That, I mean, it's kind of a miracle that you would know anything, that awareness exists. So sometimes you can know that you know. You can be mindful of yourself being mindful. For mindfulness practitioners, this is very important because ordinarily, when people bring attention to something, including mindfulness, that attention is not independent of how the attitudes we usually have about our life, the attitudes we usually go along. So if I'm anxious, then I will look out my eyes into the world in an anxious way. If I'm greedy or lustful, I will look through my eyes, look and experience the world through the filter of that greed or that lust. If I'm hateful or aversive, then how I know is colored by that aversion. And that also happens when people are mindful. It's very rare that people are completely equanimously neutral or clear when they're mindful. Often their mindfulness comes together with some of the deeper underlying attitudes that we carry with us in our life. Sometimes shifting attitudes, sometimes deeper than the shifting attitudes, but some core belief, some core attitude that is there all the time for us, kind of in the background. So that the mindfulness is not really, you know, simple. So at some point it's important to become mindful of mindfulness, mindful of how you're paying attention, to see is there any ways in which any influences that are coming to bear on how you're mindful that are a pebble for your mindfulness. And so can you find a way to take out those pebbles? And so we have in mindfulness tradition often language like mindfulness is about acceptance or being non-judgmental or non-reactive. These are all pointing to the possibility of mindfulness being there without any pebbles, without any influences from some of these underlying attitudes that we might be carrying with us. When we see that mindfulness, like some people practice mindfulness, they're very serious Buddhist practitioners, they've understood that Buddhism is mysteriously profound and very hard to get to, and so they're going to be the best, deepest, most profound Buddhist on their block. They're the ones who's going to, get it. And so they kind of huff and they puff and they sit strong and serious and they're straining to get something. And so the mindfulness itself has a strain, this pushing, this leaning into the future, concern about the future is part of it. So if you're mindful of mindfulness, you'll notice that the strain of the striving there, and then you can take that pebble out, you can relax. Not to relax so you don't be mindful, but so you can be mindful in a way that's more relaxing, more satisfying, more meaningful, lighter, more open. So as we begin doing this work, at some point we become mindful of mindfulness, and it becomes a very powerful door to begin looking into our deeper attitudes. Helping the mindfulness becomes the knowing, the mindfulness, the awareness. And one of the ways you know that mindfulness is becoming simpler or cleaner, has less pebbles, is that a moment of mindfulness is satisfying. A moment of mindfulness is settling. It feels good. It's kind of like calming. If a moment of mindfulness makes you tense or anxious or has no beneficial effect, or you don't feel kind of a little bit lighter, a little more open, or a little bit more settling, chances are your mindfulness has a lot of influences to bear on it. And you're entangled and caught in what you're mindful of. So you can look and see, what's the quality of this mindfulness awareness I have? Is it settling or not? So then, as this investigation, onward leading, inviting inspection, visible here and now, continues, at some point, one of the things you might see that is bearing an influence on your awareness, your mindfulness, how you attend to things, how you're present, is your sense of self. There's a self-image, a self-representation, an idea of yourself. I'm the great Buddhist. I'm the person who's going to get to be the best meditator on my block. We'll give out badges at IMC for best meditator. So that I can go be proud, So the mindfulness practice is connected with pride, perhaps. or perhaps it's the opposite. You might have such poor self-image, self-idea, they say, you know, this I can't do anything, this is hopeless. And so built into the mindfulness is this sense of, I'm hopeless, I can't do it. Buddhism is profound and lofty, and who am I? I can't. And so sometimes the sense of self is conceited, and sometimes it's deflating, inflating and deflating. Neither are necessary. And so as we become mindful of how we're practicing, sometime at some point we become aware that there's a sense of self operating. And that sense of self gets more and more subtle, because it might have be nothing to do with inflation and deflation. Just the very idea, the sense, that I am the one who's practicing mindfulness is extra as a pebble at some point. Someone who's new to meditation, you don't tell them that, because it just confuses them. And they'll ask questions like, well, who's supposed to meditate if I'm not meditating? Of course I'm meditating. But as we get calmer and stiller and more focused, more concentrated, as we remove the pebbles more and more, at some point you'll see that even the sense that I am meditating is extra, is not needed. It's kind of like wind drag. It's a little bit like a little pebble. And so then it might be interesting to try to put that aside and to be aware without any notion, any construction, any activity of the mind that says, I am aware. And so here we're doing something which for some people is very radical, and maybe something they've very seldom done in their life, and that is had an experience of themselves without it being self-referential. And most people are constantly self-referential. And to go into deeper and deeper states of peace without it being at all self-referential is one of the most beautiful things that one can experience. And as this happens, you get a deeper and fuller sense of what it's like to let go of pebbles, how radical it is. The fact that the Dharma is visible here and now in removal of greed, hate, and delusion might seem kind of simplistically ethical or not so profound. But when you start appreciating that as you go down to layers and shedding and freeing yourself of the subtle, even something so subtle as I am meditating, is a little bit of clinging involved in that, a little bit of extra holding. You let go of that too. And then at some point, the transformation, the openness, the freedom, the lightness, the independence that a person experiences feels sacred, feels special, feels like one of the most meaningful things a person can have happen in a person's life. And it's really good to know there's a path that leads to that, but the path that leads to it is not found by striving for it, straining for it, striving maybe is okay the right way, but straining for it, but is found by these little, all the little steps of removing pebbles as you go along. You remove the pebbles that you can. You release the holding that you can let go of, and then trust the path to where it goes. So a person who gets a sense of this understands how this works. At some point, they attain something which in Buddhism, in early Buddhism, was considered very important. And that attainment was described as becoming independent in the Dharma. Becoming independent in the Dharma. And that's the direction we're supposed to be going. Independent of Dharma means now you know for yourself so well that you know what it's about. And you don't need anybody else to tell you anymore. You don't need anybody else to support you anymore, because you understand for yourself what the path is involved, where the Dharma is discovered, and who is it that has to do it. And you know it so well and so thoroughly that you become someone who becomes a gift to the world rather than a burden to the world. So, that's the Dharma. So hopefully that was understandable and okay. And may each of you become independent in the Dharma. Thank you.